We're going to look at a story about corrupt statesmen, about empowered women, epic parties, and an attempted genocide. It's full of political satire, it's got cliffhangers, it's got jealousy, treachery, romance, betrayal, bloodshed, and a reasonably happy ending. I put a lot of that description on Facebook about this new series, as Lynn suggested, and somebody commented that at first they thought I was talking about something current, which just goes to show how relevant the Bible is, because this story is actually 2,500 years old. And it's the story of Esther from the Old Testament. If you've got your Bible, and this is a good moment, incidentally, for me to do my regular encouragement to bring your own Bible to the church so you can follow the passage for yourself and you can underline things and make notes in the margins and so on and check the context. And if anyone hasn't got a readable translation of the Bible and you're not sure what to get, then do come and talk to me about it and I'll give you some suggestions. But if you have got your Bible, please do now turn to the book of Esther. It's quite a short book, so you might need to use the contents page to find it. It's roughly in the middle of your Bibles, just before the big books of Job and Psalms and Proverbs. And can I suggest that between now and next week, you take the opportunity to read through the whole story of Esther for yourself. It's very readable. It's just 10 chapters. It's a great story, so make sure you do that, and you'll be ready for the stuff to come, and you'll meet the characters involved. For today, we're just going to be in chapter 1. So let's start at the beginning. These events, it says, happened in the days of King Xerxes, who reigned over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Ethiopia. Now, depending on which translation you have, you might see this guy called King Ahasuerus. It is the same person, and in fact there are other variations on it as well. Just depends on whether you get the name from Hebrew or Greek or Persian or Babylonian. I'm going to call him Xerxes because that's easier to say. Now, I'm not going to go into the history here, but just briefly to set this in context, the year is 484 BC. The Jews are in exile, so this is a few years after Daniel and co. were around, and it's a few years before Nehemiah. Xerxes is the ruler of the Persian Empire, which was huge. It was the biggest empire the world had ever known at that point, stretching from Africa over here, Egypt and Ethiopia, all the way through. This is... Okay, so here's, yes, Syria and Israel, as we know it today, is up here. It goes through bits of modern-day Turkey and Iraq and Iran, up into almost, oh, there's Turkey, yes, up into almost Greece, but not quite. That's late, a later part of the story. Through Pakistan, Afghanistan, lots of some of the sort of Eastern European stans, which... if you wonder about it, you can ask Alan, all the way across to India over here. So, I mean, it's just immense, absolutely immense. And it was founded by Cyrus the Great. You might remember his name from the story of Daniel. Cyrus was actually a remarkably good king. A lot of kings and queens get the title the Great, but Cyrus really was great. He was a good king. But his grandson Xerxes... not so much. Not so much. Nevertheless, the point is that as our story begins, he is literally the most powerful man in the world. Verse 2. At that time, Xerxes ruled his empire from his royal throne at the fortress of Susa. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. He invited all the military officers of Persia and Media, as well as the princes and nobles of the provinces. The celebration lasted, get this, 180 days. A tremendous display of the opulent wealth of his empire and the pomp and splendor of his majesty. When it was all over, the king gave a banquet for all the people, from the greatest to the least, who were in the fortress of Susa. It lasted for 7 days. and was held in the courtyard of the palace garden. The courtyard was beautifully decorated with white cotton curtains and blue hangings, which were fastened with white linen cords and purple ribbons to silver rings embedded in marble pillars. Gold and silver couches stood on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother-of-pearl, and other costly stones. Drinks were served in gold goblets of many designs, and there was an abundance of royal wine reflecting the king's generosity. By edict of the king, no limits were placed on the drinking, for the king had instructed all his palace officials to serve each man as much as he wanted. Let me just pause there for a moment. I don't know how many of you are fans of Friday night comedy on the BBC, on BBC Radio 4. Every Friday evening at 6:30 after the news, Radio 4 has one of three different shows. It's either the News Quiz or the Now Show or Dead Ringers. And if you don't know them, they're all quite different. But what they have in common, apart from being extremely funny, is that they are all about political satire, which is where you use humour and irony and ridicule to expose foolishness or corruption. Satire is not a new concept, because that is exactly what the writer of this book is doing here. This is satire. And as the story goes on, you can imagine it being the basis of a satirical comedy sketch. The point that the writer is making is not the glory and the power and the wealth of the king. The point that he's making is that King Xerxes wants everyone to know the glory and power and wealth. The whole thing is very carefully staged and orchestrated by King Xerxes to display just that, just how fabulously wealthy he is. He spends 6 months showing off the splendor and the pomp of his greatness to his lieutenants and nobles and princes. Then when that first feast is over, there is another party in the garden this time for the common citizens of the city of Susa with wine, women, and song. It lasts a whole week. And look at verse 6. The Hebrew is unusual there. One commentator tries to capture something of the sense of it by translating verse 6 like this. And oh, the white cotton curtains and violet hangings. And oh, the couches of gold and silver and the mosaic pavement of porphyry and marble and mother of pearl. Oh, the grandeur. Oh, the glory. Oh, the opulence. This is a place designed to stun, to take your breath away, to leave you gawking and speechless as you walk in, and in absolutely no doubt about the personal power and glory and wealth of the man whose residence it was. Verses 7 and 8 tell us the wine is flowing freely. You can imagine the kind of party it rapidly became. In verse 8, Xerxes declares the drinking rule. There is no compulsion, is what the words literally say. And there is another irony. This micromanaging megalomaniac king needs to put in rules for how people drink at his party. Xerxes wants us to bow before him in awe and reverence. He wants to be adored by his subjects, feared by his enemies, obeyed by everyone. He wants total control. And that is exactly what the writer of the book is trying to show us. An ostentatious king who wants to show off his greatness, but who in fact has no inner strength of character at all. And constantly, as we'll see, he needs other people to make up his mind about stuff. Then in verse 9, on to the next party. And in fact, if you haven't already spotted this, this whole book actually is one long series of parties. Verse 9, at the same time, Queen Vashti gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. Queen Vashti, as we will see, is drop-dead gorgeous. She is the king's trophy wife. She is a stunning beauty. And by contrast, her party actually looks quite restrained. Then on to verse 10. On the seventh day of the feast, when King Xerxes was in high spirits because of the wine, he told the seven eunuchs who attended him to bring Queen Vashti to him with the royal crown on her head. He wanted the nobles and all the other men to gaze on her beauty, for she was a very beautiful woman. And there's a kind of suggestion in the text here that when the king says, come wearing your crown, what he meant was that was the only thing she was supposed to be wearing. But when they conveyed the king's order to Queen Vashti, she refused to come. This is extraordinary. Vashti says, no. No, thank you. Come and parade myself before a crazed, drunken mob after 7 days of partying. I don't think so. I think I'll just stay home and wash my hair. So the king hears this, and he replies, you know, you're right, that would have been so embarrassing. I'm so sorry I mentioned it. No, actually, that's not what he says. Verse 12, this made the king furious, and he burned with anger. Because what Vashti has done is to strike at his sense of power and dominance and his image projection and his pleasure, which is what he is all about. She has made him look weak. She is his tool, his plaything. And he wants to show her off before the leering stares of his generals to make himself look good. But she won't come. So he turns to his lawyers, verse 13. He immediately consulted with his wise advisors, who knew all the Persian laws and customs, for he always asked their advice. They met with the king regularly and held the highest positions in the empire. And again, this is a huge irony. This is the most powerful guy in the world, and he can't control his wife, so he goes to the Supreme Court and makes this a matter of state. What am I going to do with my wife? Verse 15, what must be done to Queen Vashti, the king demanded. What penalty does the law provide for a queen who refuses to obey the king's orders properly sent through his eunuchs? Honestly, he is so shallow, he can't get beyond the fact that he followed the correct etiquette for sending a message to his wife. Doesn't matter what the message says, he followed the procedure. Verse 16, one of the advisors, Memucan, answered the king and his nobles. Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also every noble and citizen throughout your empire. Women everywhere will begin to despise their husbands when they learn that Queen Vashti has refused to appear before the king. Before this day is out, the wives of all the king's nobles throughout Persia and Media will hear what the queen did and will start treating their husbands the same way. There will be no end to their contempt and anger. I mean, for goodness sake, next they'll be asking for the vote, asking for equal pay, demanding to play on our golf courses. What are they to do? They advise the king to issue an executive order. If it please the king, we suggest that you issue a written decree, a law of the Persians and Medes that cannot be revoked. It should order that Queen Vashti be forever banished from the presence of King Xerxes. And you can't help but feel that Vashti actually must have been delighted at that idea. And that the king should choose another queen more worthy than she. When this decree is published throughout the king's vast empire, husbands everywhere, whatever their rank, will receive proper respect from their wives. The king and his nobles thought this made good sense. So he followed Memucan's counsel. He sent letters to all parts of the empire, to each province in its own script and language, proclaiming that every man should be the ruler of his own home and should say whatever he pleases. So, as this story begins, we have got the most powerful man in the world, the leader of the world's superpower, who is an egotistical, narcissistic, micromanaging bully, prone to temper tantrums, who likes to talk about how fabulously rich he is. We've got his beautiful trophy wife, who is really just treated as a sex object. And we've got the king's staff, his lawyers and advisors, who are there to agree with him and tell him how wonderful he is. Now, at first glance, all that is really hard to relate to, because obviously none of that sort of thing would ever happen today, would it? I mean, it's just inconceivable. But as tempting as it might be to draw parallels to other people in the world today, I think we'd be missing the primary points if we spent our time doing that. Instead, there are two questions that I want us to ask as we go through this whole book. And actually, these are pretty good questions to ask for any study of the Bible. The first question is, what can I learn about God here? I mean, that's a pretty obvious question for the Bible generally. What can I learn about God's character and God's actions and God's promises? Obvious question for the Bible, but it hasn't actually got quite such an obvious answer in this book. Did anyone notice how many times God was mentioned in that first chapter? I'll give you a clue. It's the same number of times that God is mentioned in the whole of the rest of the book. None. God is not mentioned by name once in this whole book. And yet, by the time we come to the end of the book, the question that we'll be asking is, how, and if you're a visitor, don't worry, that's not today. We're not going to be here for the next 3 hours. The question that we will be asking is, how could any of that have happened except by God's hand? The fact is that very often in the Bible, we read things like Moses met with God, or God said this to Elijah, or David asked God about that. And sometimes that happens today. Sometimes we do meet with or speak with God in a very literal way. But most of the time, for most of us, we don't hear God's voice in that way. We don't meet him walking around as a tangible presence. And the way we're going to see God working and acting and responding and speaking throughout this story is actually really encouraging for those times when it almost feels like God is hiding. When we know he's there because he's God and he promises he will always be with us, but he just keeps stubbornly silent. So watch out through this book for a very silent but very active God as the story unfolds. That was my first question. The second question we need to ask is this: what can I learn here about myself? What lessons are there here that I can apply to my own life? Because one of the key things about all the people we read about in the Bible is that they are people just like you and me. They are just people. Some of them may have jobs or roles that seem very different to us, because as far as I'm aware, there are no world leaders here with us today. Some of them might have experiences that we've never had. Some of them might be in contexts that seem very different to what we know today. But nevertheless, they are just regular human beings. There are no superheroes in the Bible. And the thoughts and the fears and the worries and the temptations and the habits and the emotions that all these people go through are exactly what you and I might face. That's one of the reasons why the book, why the Bible is so powerful. So in this chapter, we might laugh at King Xerxes, the writer wants us to, but only as a way to teach us to laugh at ourselves and all the temptations of a world that fixates on what you have and what you wear and where you went to school and what you do and who you know. The author of Esther is laughing at the ridiculous spectacle of this pompous man, Xerxes. He doesn't realize that a person's life does not consist in the abundance of things. And he does so in the hope that the same realization will begin to dawn on us. If Xerxes appears ridiculous, how much more ridiculous are we when we spend so much time and energy on, well, you fill in the blank, a new car, a great pair of shoes, the latest home improvements. Ultimately, it is all empty. True value lies in an altogether different empire. Esther wants us to view the world and its values, the things that it prizes and what it runs after and longs for, with different eyes, and to see them for the empty and futile pursuits that they really are. Because, just to finish, Esther 1 is intended to make us long for a different kingdom and a better king. Here in this chapter is earthly power at its pinnacle. Here is the highest a person can rise in this world's estimation, yes? Here is glory and influence and pleasure and success. But as we read it, it leaves us with a bitter taste in our mouths. It leaves us uneasy and discontent and struck again by the absurdity of a life that is lived in pursuit of those things. It leaves us longing for a better kingdom and a better king, one whose rule is just rather than random and impulsive, one whose invitations to us are marked by love, not by lust or a will to power, who does not view his bride as an instrument for bigging himself up, but who gives himself up for her. It leaves us longing for Jesus. His kingdom is not marked by fabulous displays of earthly glory. He is frankly unimpressed with the trappings of external influence or prestige. He does not choose, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he does not choose many who are wise according to this world's standard, nor many who are powerful, nor many who are of noble birth. That's not what Christ's kingdom looks like. He chooses the foolish and the weak and the low and the despised in the world, people counted as nothing at all, and uses them to bring to nothing what the world considers important, so that no human being may boast in the presence of God. Unlike Xerxes, Jesus is a king who came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. He is a king crowned with thorns, to whom homage was paid, but by mocking soldiers who crucified him. A king who found his empire as nails were pounded through his flesh, and he was hung on a cross at Calvary. Whose subjects are bound to him not in servile fear, but by the strongest cords of love. Jesus is a better king, and he calls us all to come to him. You can sympathize with Vashti, can't you? Why on earth would she come at Xerxes' beck and call? But Jesus is a different king, a better king. He loves his people, and his invitations to us are always invitations of grace and mercy and hope. He is a king in whose rule we can rest securely, a husband in whose love we can trust completely, a sovereign in whose power we can always flee to take refuge. So why refuse to come to him when he calls?